It's the last week of this season of Invisibilia, the show about the invisible forces shaping human behavior. In their final episodes, co-hosts Elise Spiegel and Hanna Rosin are looking at the concepts we have about ourselves. Who are we really? Is there one true version of the self? And this image of who we think we are, how does it limit us and push us to do the things we never thought we could? You can listen to Invisibilia in the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we are wrestling, sorry, with the women of Netflix's Glow. Plus, we'll bring you our recent conversation with Lena Waithe of Master of None. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And this week in our fourth chair, we are always so excited to see our friend Kat Chow from the NPR Code Switch team. Hi, Kat.
Hi, Linda.
How are you doing?
I'm great.
You're awesome. With us. You're with us in D.C. You're often in New York, but you're with us in D.C.
Yes, I'm here sweating in D.C. I'm so happy about it, though.
That's right. So. Sweating in D.C. with the rest of us. Well, back in 1986, a syndicated TV show called Glow, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling premiered, and now Netflix is dramatizing, or rather comedifying, the development of that project with its 10-part series, Glow. It stars Alison Brie as a down-on-her-luck actress who dreams of more serious roles, Betty Gilpin as a former soap star taking her first job since having a baby, Marc Maron as the director trying to pull the whole thing together, and a large cast of women who do indeed pull each other hair. The series was co-created by Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch, who have, between the two of them, worked on Orange is the New Black, Nurse Jackie, and Weeds. When I think comedic shows about wrestling, I think Glenn Weldon. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I have no reason. How did this strike you, buddy?
I like this a lot, and I wasn't anticipating liking it a lot because I have absolutely no interest in the subject matter. Not female wrestling, not wrestling. It's just I'm just not a wrestling guy. I never have been. So it's kind of like Friday Night Lights in that way.
Sure.
I don't care about football, but I like the show. After the first episode, I thought, okay, I get what this is. This is Tootsie with pile drivers, right?
Right.
And I figure that's where the show was going. As the show goes along, I've seen seven episodes by now, it deepens, it broadens, mm-hmm. and we see more of the cast. That really helps. And in speaking of casting, Alison Brie is somebody that I think if she hasn't been in our topic, people were pulling for,
right.
She should have been. She was honorary in there.
Sure.
It's so good to see her get a role that she can sink her teeth into, that she can actually expand and really live in. But how is it possible that Marc Maron seems more perfectly cast for this role than he does for the IFC show on which he plays himself?
No, it's funny because did you hear the WTF where he was talking to Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon about The Big Sick?
Not yet.
So Maron had them on talking about The Big Sick, and one of the things they were talking about was being a comedian and then doing acting. At this point, he doesn't really feel like he's stretched a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And when I watched this, I thought, yeah, I would agree with that. And I agree with you. I think Alison Brie, although she's played sort of comedy on Community and more drama on Mad Men, she's always kind of been a little bit of a delicate flower,
mm-hmm.
I guess
yeah.
I would say, either a funny one or a more dramatic one. And here she's much more... I mean, she is still that in a way, but she's much more kind of frank and weird in a great way.
She's totally.
She's weak more than delicate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's more flawed, I think.
Yeah.
I really liked Alison so far. So I only watched four episodes. I'm curious to see how it unfolds. But I loved how she was able to bring this, like, cringiness to her character,
mm-hmm.
where I've always thought that Alison Brie in her characters, even on, like, Community, for instance, there is this element where the way she acts... It's not like she's overacting, but the character that she plays in Glow really tends to do that, where there's something very theatrical about her
right.
and the performance that she gives in a lot of her characters is like that. And so I thought it really suited her and her expressions. I almost didn't recognize her at first.
Yeah.
And they're just so on point.
Yeah. Well, she does have an 80s perm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some 80s eyebrows.
And she's serving you a little Shelley Long in Cheers. Mm. That's the persona a little bit.
Oh, interesting.
That's a good comparison.
Like... Mm. annoying.
Yeah, like, that's solid.
Just a thin thread of annoying, but owns it.
And well, kind of pretentious, too.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think what makes her like Shelley Long in Cheers is she thinks she's better than the situation she's in. Mm-hmm. She sort of feels like she's slumming. And part of the show is a little bit like Orange is the New Black, which this show has some of the same DNA. It's about somebody realizing that they actually belong in the situation they're in more than they think they are.
Interesting. And I do think that they play with the idea that she is, she turns out to really be made for this because she does have this, what you would consider overdramatic flair, which if there's a place that you can deploy your overdramatic flair, it's in wrestling. And I don't mean that to be a negative statement at all. It's just that it's a very exaggerated sort of form.
Yeah, that's one of the minor quibbles with the show is that in incorporating the kind of larger-than-life aspects of wrestling, in the cast and in the writing sometimes there's a broadness, it's a little uneven to me. I mean, there's some jokes and some characters who are much bigger, and it takes a while for that sort of rhythm to kind of find itself. Yeah. Tonally, there's a weirdness there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thought that I had watching this was I can't wait to see the second season. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what you're getting as this first season unfolds is you're finding out who these people are.
Right.
And if I had a quibble with it, and ultimately I really love this show, it doesn't have as many jokes as you think it's going to. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily as dramatic as you think it's going to be. So, like, it's a dramedy that's not necessarily high on comedy or high on drama. What it has in spades is character development.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what has just pulled me very kind of deeply into this show, is I love the way these characters are finding themselves as the show is finding the characters.
Yeah. How long did it take to grab you, Kat?
I was pretty grabbed in the first episode. I mean, I think there is a twist that happens pretty quickly, I think, within the first two. And it was really, it was when I realized that Alison Brie's character, Ruth, was not as perfect or even good of a person as I thought. Because I think often when I watch dramedies like this, it's so easy to just like root for the person because she's not annoying. She's not X or Y or Z. And I realize now that I'm assigning a lot of these traits to a woman character. But there was something that she did that she understood and realized was just bad and just crappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when I started to actually like the show a lot.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So for me, I liked the kind of line-to-line writing. Mm-hmm. I like the rhythms of it. I think Maron is really funny.
Yeah.
And I read a thing about how he, like, auditioned on his iPhone or something like that. And I was like, he auditioned?
Wow,
like, this
exactly.
wasn't just written
wasn't
as
written
Mark Maron.
Yeah. But, Mark Maron says.
But I very much enjoyed the characterizations, as Steven said. I enjoy the, you know, that they do lean into the perms and the hair and all that stuff. On a story level, there is a lot of the kind of League of Their Own. Here's all these women who come together. And, of course, they don't really know what they're doing. And this man who's all washed up, this is kind of his way of getting back on top, is to kind of get all these women
assemble
this team of women for this ragtag project. And he's sort of the genius who sees where it all needs to go. And as the season goes along, there are a number of story choices that I just thought were not as interesting as I wanted them to be. So for me, it's a story that I was kind of in the opposite position from Steven. I cared about the minute-to-minute writing. I liked the performances. I liked the style of it. But the bigger story and the character stuff, I actually was not as interested in, to be honest. Yeah.
It was fun seeing Chris Lowell back, old Piz from Veronica Mars, as the squirrely, coked up, I guess, producer.
Yeah. Benefactor.
I mean, playing the James Spader role, the 80s James Spader role, to a T.
Yeah, I think he's slightly more benign than maybe most of your James Spader 80s villains. But I do want to bring up, because, you know, Kat is a member of our team that covers race and ethnicity and culture. I do want to talk a little bit about the fact that I think they are open about the way that wrestling in the 80s, and I honestly, I'm not sure how true it is now, but certainly in this world, a lot of the kind of easy, over-the-top hero-villain stuff was, in some cases, profoundly racist.
Right.
And some of it was just, you know, they go straight to, like, there's a black woman who plays welfare queen. There's an Asian woman who's fortune cookie. Like, I wasn't sure how much I felt like the show earned that or dealt with it well.
So when I saw that sort of episode crop up where they started making fun of these stereotypes and trying to really lean into them, there is this point where the character who's the welfare queen says something that felt very on the nose to me, where she says something like, you know, I don't know about this. My son, he goes to Stanford, really emphasizing that he's educated and, you know, he's Black.
Yeah.
And I guess it reminded me of Aziz Ansari's Master of None in that episode, Indians on TV. And I kept comparing the two, and I don't know if it's fair to compare the two, but I kept comparing them because Indians on TV is really similar, except it's a person of color who is owning that story and telling that even as the character. And so there was some dynamic that felt off. I mean, I'm open, of course, because I've only watched four episodes. Maybe there are some other characters who are going to crop up who...
Yeah, I mean, they hit it harder later, but I'm not sure if they get there in terms of an analysis.
Yeah.
And one of my beefs with it, one of my concerns about it, was the character who says that she's part Cherokee. It's not just that the way that they eventually create her wrestling persona is racist, but she as a character, she as a real person from this family of quiet giants, that felt off to me anyway. And I don't necessarily know that they're getting there in the right way.
Okay.
I don't know.
See, I'm not sure they aren't. And I mean, one element of the structure that they're clearly setting up is a little bit similar to Orange is the New Black, where you're starting to get that thing where each episode is kind of starting to highlight a different character. I had this reaction to it of like, I can't wait to see where it goes. I can't wait to see season two. Part of the reason for that is I feel like they're bringing more out of each character as the season progresses.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's definitely an element of the wrestling personas. And it's interesting to see how they handle it as part of the actual
very meta
characters.
Yeah, and they also handle something that I haven't seen dealt with on television at all, much less in movies or any kind of medium, which is somebody who identifies as something other than human. That is the first portrayal I think I have ever seen. And it's a relatively sympathetic one.
Yeah.
And surprising in a show that is playing into racial stereotypes in a very meta way.
Right, yeah. I think one of the difficulties of it is, like, whenever you have a cast of 12 or 14 similarly sized characters, right? Like, you know, this is the crew, this is the group. It is really hard to serve all of them,
right?
You know, and so you do wind up with either that structure that Stephen is talking about, where they're individually highlighted for one episode, or you wind up with a situation where you're kind of giving a handful of lines to each of them, you know?
I do think some of them are starting to pop. Even something as simple as Betty Gilpin as the main character's best friend. You know, that was a character who in the beginning is one thing and evolves into another thing. In the beginning, she's just sort of lugging around this weirdly mute baby.
Yeah. I noticed that too.
This baby is this silent prop for the first few episodes. And then they allow that character to have a real transformation.
I like that performance a lot.
I like that performance a lot, but it led me to believe there are a lot of characters on this show that they can do that with, that they have now the raw materials to do
that's
that
a good
with.
Point. Yeah.
If you like this show, you should check out a recent episode of the Paul F. Tompkins podcast, Spontanea Nation, where he has on Alison Brie and several members from this cast, Rebecca Johnson, who plays Dawn, Kimmy Gatewood, who plays Stacy, and Jackie Tone, who plays Melrose. And they just, you know, they tell stories about filming and how much they all just got into it and how there were some injuries, as you might imagine. But they just had this natural, easy chemistry, which I think comes through on screen.
Yeah. How did you feel about actually watching them wrestle?
I just kept thinking about all of the stunts and the stunt people, the stunt woman who probably had to come in and just figure out how to portray these people who don't know how to do it. I thought it was really interesting and fun.
I don't know how much they used stunt folk. I know that they had some training. I know they spent a number of weeks training to wrestle. And the good thing is they don't have to look like good wrestlers.
Right.
They have to look like so-so wrestlers, which I think they do for most of it, even when they're...
Lots of hugging.
Even as they get better. Well, yeah. One thing that I did like about it is I like the way they handle, and I say this as, like Glenn, not a wrestling aficionado, but I do like the portrayal of wrestling in this show in such a way that the whole idea of quote-unquote fake or not fake seems beside the point,
right?
It is choreographed in advance, but real in the sense that, like anything else, like dance or anything else that's physical, A, it takes skill. B, it contains risk.
Yeah.
And C, you have to work very well with the other person and right. all of that stuff. And it takes a ton of practice and learning.
Yeah. I mean, they do establish that, like, even if you do it right, it takes a toll. Mm-hmm. It is an athletic pursuit that beats the hell out of you.
Yeah. And I think that's true of a lot of the women who are actually involved in GLOW. I was reading about some of them this morning, and I think that's a complicated story. There's a documentary about it that I am going to watch. Haven't watched yet, but this made me curious enough to watch it. And I think there is some complicated history. It was a, you know, syndicated show, and I don't think it set everybody up for life, to say the least.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be interesting to see how this show being successful, which I think it will be, kind of reignites interest in the actual 80s history of ladies wrestling. There are also, I want to point out, there are also a lot of really interesting directors on some of these episodes.
Yeah.
Lynn Shelton directed one. Melanie Mayron, who was on 30-something long ago and has done a bunch of directing since then, did one. So there's also a really interesting, you know, crop of directors who worked on it.
I also got to point out the music and the costuming and the makeup, they do work.
They do work
on this show.
Yeah. I do feel like I've had a lot of the 80s pop music kind of business and the period pop music as an element of shows in the last few years. And I don't know whether it still charms me as much as it originally did.
It also feels a little more early 80s than late 80s to me.
That's true. I wouldn't know those dates as well as perhaps you do, but I hear you.
And I don't really know any of these things.
I was just going to say, this is all.
I
was like, I like the sneakers Alison Brie's wearing. I think they're coming back.
Yeah, well, a lot of that is real. I mean, a lot of that, I can tell you, is sadly real fashion. And apparently Alison Brie got a real perm. That's what I heard. Which is, I mean, that's sacrifice. Right?
That's method right there.
Yeah, that is sacrifice. That is method. Well, as you get a chance to see GLOW, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and let us know what you think. When we come back, we're going to bring you our conversation with Master of None's Lena Waith, recorded at our recent live show at Largo at the Coronet in Los Angeles. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Latote, a fashion subscription box that sends brand name clothing and accessories right to your door for one low monthly fee. Get unlimited totes each month. Simply wear what you want, return everything in the mail when you're done, and repeat. Items you love can be purchased for a discounted price. To get started, go to latote.com. That's LETOTE.com. Enter promo code HAPPYHOUR at checkout to get 50% off your first month.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. At our recent live show in Los Angeles at Largo at the Coronet, we were fortunate enough to have a conversation with Lena Waith, who you might know as one of the stars of Master of None. She also developed a project with Showtime called The Chi, which will be upcoming. And we talked to her about those projects and some of her own history, as well as the episode that she wrote of Master of None called Thanksgiving. So here it is.
Hey, hey.
Hey.
Yes. Come on, hipsters. Hi.
Thank you for doing this.
Of course.
It's good to see you. The hotel that we are staying in, there is a giant, for your consideration, Master of None billboard across the street from our hotel.
You know what? It better be one.
That's right. So these guys, I think, had quite a reaction to Master of None.
That's what we hope for.
I was reading about how you wound up on that show, and I was wondering if you could tell that story.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I like to give glory to God up above. I don't like to really take credit for a lot of this stuff, because I think, you know, the universe and all this space kind of like, it sort of conspires, you know, sometimes for certain things to happen. Because literally, Allison Jones, who's a phenomenal casting director, you know, called my manager at the time and was like, you know, come into the office, let's sit and talk. And she's like, do you have any interest in acting? I said, I do not. She's like, okay. I'll bring you in for stuff anyway. And so she did. And I ended up getting a little tiny part on The Comeback, which is super cool, and in the second season. And then I guess Aziz one day just asked her, because she was casting their show, was like, just send me interesting people, which is a classic Aziz Ansari thing. And so for some reason, like, she thought of me and sent me to his house, his lovely home, walked by his Tesla and talked to him and Alan. And, you know, I was just like myself. I just like walked in, not on like an outfit like that I'm in right now, and talked about my life, like falling in love with my girlfriend and just being my gay black self. And I got a call. They were like, yeah, we want you to come in and read. And so I came in and read with him. And being the writer that I am, I said, can I punch up the scene? And they're like, sure. So when I was reading with Aziz, I was like riffing and saying stuff to him. I think I made a joke about like Cassie or something, or I think I said thought in that thing. And Aziz was like, what is a thought? And I was like, that hoe over there. And, you know, and so we just really vibed instantly. And oddly enough, we have a lot of the similar cultural references. You know, he like listens to the Kanye songs before me. He's like, did you hear new Kanye? Like, no, man, you probably got the direct download. Like, I didn't hear that. So we just like ended up vibing, and he ended up, you know, I did a call back and tested, and I got a call, and he's like, come to New York and play with my friend. I was like, cool.
Yeah.
Here we are.
So there was a lot of talk, I felt like, after this second season, mm-hmm. about Thanksgiving, which she wrote.
Yeah.
Do you want to describe a little bit about that episode?
Thanksgiving is an episode that follows Denise's coming out story, which mirrors Lena's coming out story. And, you know, The Room came up with a really cool idea of, like, why not tell it over a series of Thanksgivings? And so we would play with time, and we would start with, like, Denise and Dev's kids, and we would kind of have a bit of an origin story for them. And the cool thing about it was, because I was telling Aziz and Alan about my coming out, and the cool thing that they sort of picked up on was that it wasn't just, yes, it's technically one conversation, but coming out really sort of takes place over, you know, decades, because you know you're gay very early on, and it's just sort of like little signs that you show and that come up over the course of your life and you having to come out. But there's nothing more fun or interesting than coming out to a straight black woman in her 50s. And to have Angela Bassett come and play that person is a once in a lifetime opportunity. You know, that's when you can kind of go by God's grace again, because then have Kim Whitley play a version of your aunt. Like literally all combined into one person, Kim Whitley, who I think is the unsung hero of that episode. She's phenomenal. So yeah, and then Melina Masukis came on board and to direct, who is amazing and wonderful, and is my new sister from The Mister. I love her very much. But yeah, we were like we want to make it really black, very female, very specific, and gay as hell. And they were like, okay. And the fact that people responded to that episode so well is like, we have overcome. We're overcoming. We're trying to get there.
I had a couple of conversations with people about how sort of specific the references were in that episode.
Oh yeah.
They're all very, very particular. Are those your references?
Absolutely. And big ups to like Netflix and Aziz for like letting me roll. But like the truth is, I really, and Aziz and I, we actually wrote, because I was in London filming. And so Aziz came to London and we wrote the episode there, and we were just kind of like sitting around. And I was thinking back on my childhood about the conversations I would ear hustle, you know, and being at the table. It was like I wasn't allowed to talk and be involved because it was grown folks talking. But I got to listen to the conversations they had. And I was like literally lived with my grandmother, my mom, my aunt would be over at the house all the time. The other female neighbors would come over and they would be talking about what was happening. And that's where I learned how to be a sassy black woman, like talking about the OJ thing. Like that's where I learned about race. You know, that's what I knew what it meant to hear them say, oh, well, see, OJ wouldn't be having these problems if he didn't have no white woman. Remember when he was married to the black wife? Mm-hmm. Everything was fine. Then he got with her. And now here we are, you know, they try to frame up like all this kind of stuff. And it's just like, it all sort of came flowing back, and there was that sort of like that protective thing that they would have over these sort of icons that they protected and that represented the race in a way. And they were like, you can't come for the icons. And so just like those things I remembered, and you know, Aziz and I didn't want to shy away from the conversations that are happening now. People are talking about, you know, like the Sandra Blands and the Trayvon Martins, all that kind of stuff. And so we really wanted to be specific, and we kind of wanted those conversations at the table to evolve a little bit, but then not.
Yeah.
Which was kind of very telling about the world we live in. And also, too, is like that's what happens, especially in black households. You know, you come around the table and you talk about what's going on in the paper. And it's like The View been around since the beginning of the time, you know. I think we've always had opinions about things and like and talked about it over food. And so I think to me, I always think about the episode. Yes, it's a great queer, you know, brown person coming out, but it's also a tribute, I think, to black women.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is one of the things that I also love about that episode is the evolution of Denise's mom's relationship to her girlfriend. Mm-hmm. The sort of the that it goes from being a kind of a hostile to a
very hostile.
How did you kind of decide to place those steps over those Thanksgivings?
Well, I think we definitely want to go with the rule of three, you know, which in comedy is sort of like 101. Yeah. And so we were like, okay, so the first time is not going to be fun. It's going to be awkward and weird, which was really fun to write. Like in real life, my mother said, you cannot tell your grandmother. So I didn't. Yeah. And she has since passed and, you know, she's in heaven now. But I always like to think that she knew. And if she had an opportunity to meet my girlfriend, Alana, she would have embraced her, I think. And so we got to play with the greeting, you know, the mom being weird, the aunt trying to be too cool, and the grandmother just giving her a hug. And so the second time around, because we all have those times in our lives when you kind of break up with the good one and then you go to the bad one because you think that's what you want. Not the bad one, but the one that, you know, looks good on your arm but ain't really got too much to say, you know. And then of thus, Nipples and Toes 23 was born.
That was amazing.
So we wanted to do that. We kind of were like, what if we then, you know, it's one thing for your kid to be gay, but then for the person that they're dating to be like a crazy person. You're like, no, like, okay, be gay, but be with somebody that's normal.
Yeah.
And so then to bring the girlfriend back, you know, and then you get the cute new addition. It's like, okay, well, we're happy she's with this girl that's like a nice, sweet young lady who's accomplished. And so we kind of want to have that be their journey. And people really seem to like it. But we got the fun. We got a lot of fun out of Nipples and Toes, though. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Somebody told me that the next day that Nipples and Toes thing was real.
Oh,
somebody
people have changed their handles. Somebody does have the handle. A lot of people change their handles on Twitter. If we were just like, the fact that y'all want to be Nipples and Toes 23 is interesting. It's really fun. Yeah. Okay, got it.
So you didn't want to act originally. Where are you now in terms of the mix of stuff that you want to do?
You know what? Acting is really fun. You know, I think for me, it's sort of an extension of my artistry. You know, I definitely feel more comfortable sitting behind a laptop and writing voices of other characters. But getting a chance to step into a role and sort of bring that character to life is really fun for me. And also, you can't be a writer and not respect what actors do. Like, it is a wonderful marriage. Without them, our words have no voice. So for me, I've always had a love and a great appreciation for actors. So when I get an opportunity to do it, I'm a different kind of actor because I'm very much about what's on the page and what the intent is because I'm a writer as well. And I think because I'm a producer, you know, when I'm on set, I can look at the producer and know, okay, you're freaking out about this because we're going late and we're losing light. Like, there's certain things that are in my head that aren't on another actor's mind. Yeah. So I think it kind of makes me sort of this really well-rounded artist.
Yeah. You love TV, right? Growing up?
I'm obsessed with it, yeah.
And I saw you talking about Mary Tyler Moore Show, right?
Oh, that was it was one of the things that I think made me want to be a television writer.
Yeah.
I was like such an odd kid because I would be watching like Nick at Night. Like, I'd be up watching Mary Tyler Moore Show, big fan of Maude. I was very aware that I was watching old shows. And so I knew I wanted to write television, but I said, I want to write stuff like this because it wasn't just funny now, but it was funny 20 years from now. Uh-huh. Like, that's the kind of stuff I want to make that's timeless, that is still palpable to a different generation. And there's just something so just pure about that time. And so for me, that's the kind of stuff I want to make. I want to make something that's not just good today, but 20 years from now, somebody will sit and watch it and still glean something from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about The Chi?
I wrote the pilot, like, you know, a couple of years ago in my apartment in the Valley. And just was very much thinking about the headlines that were coming out of the city. And I was just like, somebody needs to put some humanness behind this because it's numbers. 32 shot killed, you know, we lost like this many people over the summer. This many people were shot and killed. And I'm like, those people have a mother, you know, they have a friend, you know, they have a favorite pair of sneakers. Like, there's always this thing to me when you would see shows, you know, about the cops and the perp. It's like, I want to know about the perp in the backseat. And not just who he is, but how did he get there? What did he have for breakfast that morning? Uh-huh. You know, what conversations did he have the night before he went to sleep? What did he dream about? I want to know that. And I think if we can tell their story and really kind of hone into that community, because there that really is, there's a, like, Chicago is rich with history. You know, it's not a perfect city by any means, but it's not just a jungle. You know, and I think there are people that are literally trying to live day to day and survive. And they have dreams, they have hopes, they have missions. And I want to tell a story about them.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think of Master of None as a obviously very differently themed, but like very much about New York. And in sort of, like I said, a very different way.
Yeah.
But also there's a lot of people just kicking around the city. And mm-hmm. When we talked about it on the show, we talked about those nights that you go out and it's sort of like nothing goes the way you expect it's going to go.
Absolutely.
And that's in that I Love New York episode.
Oh, yeah.
About how nothing turns out the normal way, but yeah. You wind up with a bunch of people you never met before.
And having an amazing time.
Yeah. I don't know. City shows are interesting.
But the city has such a heartbeat. You know what I mean? It's so palpable and it really lends itself to the story. And I'm so happy they did that episode too, which I thought was so ambitious and wonderful to really kind of follow the people, those secondary characters. I think it's very much in line of like what I'm trying to do with The Shy. It's like you want to follow the people that you don't ordinarily get to follow and follow them home and how that changes the way you think about them.
Yeah. I'm very glad that we could talk to you about Master of None and we could talk to you about The Shy. And we are hoping that you will stick around and take a very, very silly quiz with us, if that's okay.
Of course.
All right. So she did indeed stick around for the quiz. She stuck around for What's Making Us Happy. She was a great guest, Lena Waithe. And if you want to hear more about Lena Waithe and her path to success in Hollywood and her work on Master of None, check her out on It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders. You know how much we love Sam. And Sam has NPR's newest podcast. And that episode will be out Tuesday, June 27th.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Spike's all-star comedy tribute, One Night Only, Alec Baldwin. One Night Only offers a glimpse into the life of Alec Baldwin as told through hilarious and heartfelt stories from his closest friends and co-stars, including Julianne Moore, Tracy Morgan, and Kate McKinnon. It's a once-in-a-lifetime tribute honoring Baldwin's 30-year career. One Night Only with Alec Baldwin premieres Sunday, July 9th at 9, 8 Central on Spike.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, my kids have a Nintendo Switch, and for the Nintendo Switch, I bought them the game ARMS, which came out just last week. My kids have been eagerly anticipating it. It is basically a boxing game in which the fighters have arms that extend out like massive springs. And so you get the chaos of your Super Smash Bros. Mm-hmm. with the relative simplicity of something that my kid's dumb dad can play. Mm-hmm. With the bonus that because this game has just come out, it came out June 16th, my kids are not yet good at it. So I was able to play with them for this very, very, very brief period before they become wildly, wildly, wildly better than me at it. It's a very fun, very, very silly game. I don't know how enduring it's going to be, but it's a very silly kind of game. ARMS for the Nintendo Switch.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Quick correction from last week. I was talking about a film that I like a lot called Sweetie, directed by Jane Campion as an Australian. She's not Australian. She is from New Zealand. But the film is an Australian film. So slap a big old asterisk under that.
Exactly.
Lincoln in the Bardo is George Saunders, who I talked about on the show many, many times. It's his first novel, and it's about Abraham Lincoln visiting the grave of his dead son during the Civil War. And the Bardo is a Buddhist concept of an intermediate space between life and death. So lots of voices, lots of ghosts in this kind of netherworld. I am experiencing it as an audiobook with the voices of Nick Offerman, Megan Mullally, David Sedaris, Lena Dunham, Don Cheadle, Ben Stiller, Carrie Brownstein, Bill Hader, and 158 other actors.
Yeah, it's an epic audiobook. They made a big thing out of it when they were doing it.
Every one of the characters, all 166 characters in this book, is voiced by somebody else. It does not feel like your everyday audiobook at all. It feels like a giant BBC play, radio play. It's a giant production. It's 7 hours and 25 minutes long, but I am swimming in it. I just love it. It's Lincoln in the Bardo on audiobook.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
What's making me happy this week is SZA's new album, Control,
yes,
which is so good. I actually had never listened to her before. Her name is Solana Rowe. She is really talented. It's her album kind of really just speaks to young women of color, specifically young Black women, and it's gotten a lot of great reception. Her song 20-something is especially just kind of magical. And another thing is I've been reading this book called Anxious for Hawk by the author Helen MacDonald,
yep,
which is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about her grief after her father dies in 2007. He dies suddenly of a heart attack. And she takes it on herself to start training this goshawk. And her memoir is just so stunningly written. And normally it could just be a straight memoir, but she plays with format where she really kind of references this other memoir. There is another memoir about goshawks also from the, I think, late 1800s by this writer named T.H. White. So it's not just about death. It's also just about her introspection and her empathy and ability to relate to a bird. I love it. That's really kind of consuming me right now.
Yeah, me too. And if you go into that book as a fan of T.H. White, you will not come out of it as a fan of T.H. White for various reasons. It's really good history on top of everything else.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Kat Chow. I have two things because the first is really, really good, but not necessarily happy. And I do want to leave you on something happy. So the first thing is a really devastating but excellent book called Killers of the Flower Moon, which is by David Gran. And I also listened to this on audiobook. The subtitle of the book is The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. And this is the story of a series of murders of members of the Osage tribe in the 1920s. And the tribe had been very much enriched by the discovery of oil. And that's related to this string of murders that the early version of the FBI came in to try to solve. The audiobook is in three parts. And the early part is sort of the setting up of the family who was most affected. And that has one narrator. And then the middle part is the kind of the FBI section. And that has a different narrator. The third section is really the journalist going back to kind of fill in the remaining pieces of the puzzle. And that has a different narrator. And it's a very good decision, I think, to do that in three sections. And I will say the middle part, which is about like old FBI guys in the West in the 1920s, is narrated by Will Patton. If you ever have a book about cowboys, have Will Patton do the audiobook. He's so good. And it's, in a way, it's so thickly slathered on. But that's a very good audiobook. Again, Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran. I do want to leave you on a mention of a genuinely happy-making book, which is Johnny Sun's Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien Too. It is an illustrated story. If you know Johnny Sun, you can never really tell when he's going to be silly and earnest, but he's incredibly like empathetic and thoughtful. And the book is empathetic and thoughtful and weird and has silly jokes. It's about this alien who goes to Earth and he's supposed to talk to humans, but he winds up talking to animals and plants. And I'm not going to say too much more about it, except please get it. You will not be sorry. And you should. This is one that I think it's particularly special to experience as a paper book because of all the illustrations and everything. Well worth it. Johnny Sun's Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien Too. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Kat at Kat Chow. That's K-A-T-C-H-O-W. You can follow our regular producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Our producer this week is Thomas Liu. You can follow Thomas at Thomas, U-Y-L-U. And you can follow our producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.